If you have a Bible with you, open it up to a book. Maybe you don't go to very often. Go to the book of Numbers. It's in the front end, I promise. It is one of the first few books in the Bible. And you're going to want to go to chapter 13. If you do not have a Bible with you, or that's a foreign thing for you, we got black Bibles that are in the back on the tables. You can grab one. Don't feel bad about that. Take that. That's a form of stealing we're fine with. Go ahead and snag it. As you're turning to Numbers 13, one of the things that I want to bring up is a couple weeks ago, we kind of, as soon as we end one camp, we talk about another, but 2 weeks ago, we ended winter camp with a ton of snow and an amazing weekend. And one of the things that we ended our winter camp with was we very intentionally on the last day focused on what it would look like to love other people well, what it would look like to truly love other human beings well. And one of the things that Jesus says is he actually tells his disciples that, the way you go about loving one another in genuine, self-sacrificial, unlike the world around you type love is how people will know that you are my disciples. As you think about how Christians are known within our culture and community, it is very easy to be perceived a certain way. And Jesus says that the way that I want you to be perceived, the way that you represent myself and essentially God, is the way that you, in self-sacrificial love, love one another. And that is an amazing ideal, one that we strive towards. But like every ideal, like anything that God says in Scripture, these beautiful ideals of what he calls us to come colliding with the reality of life. And so you may be coming off of winter camp and go like, okay, that really spoke to me. I am realizing the ways in which I don't love well. And one of the things that we would say is that one of the very best ways to truly love another person is going to be the words you use or don't use. One of the most loving things that God has ever done for us is given us his Scripture to speak truth and grace into our own life. And so when we repeat that and speak truth and grace and life and healing to another person, we are loving them well. But then that ideal comes colliding with real life. And it comes colliding with, say, your Saturday night. And you're headed off to Tolo for a Saturday night dance. You know, who knows what kind of music they'll play? It might be weird. Maybe not. If they play MC Hammer, it's a good night. And you have great plans for the evening. And you have come off winter camp. You're like, I really do want to love people well. But then the weirdness starts because you got a group of people. And your date, who maybe you don't know very well, maybe you do, and maybe you wanted to be on this or you felt bad and so you said yes and now you're in this situation where you're not entirely there, but you're there, you want to be part of the group, but now the date that you're with has a problem with someone else in the group. And it's not exactly like your buddy, maybe it's like your date has a problem with the date of another person, like three people removed. And this causes now problems based upon where you're gonna go eat for dinner, because now this person is causing drama and they're like, hey, I don't really wanna go with those people. And you're like, yeah, but I wanna go with those people. And now you got decisions to make. Do I step into the weirdness? Do I try and pretend there's no weirdness? Do I confront, like, what do I do with this? And now all of a sudden you're stuck in these weird relationships. Maybe these people over here find out about it, and now you got two people that hate each other, and somehow you're in the same limousine, and if you're like really weird, you buy one of those like Hummer limousine things, and now it's the Hummer limousine of awkwardness, because there's drama between people. I recall when I was in high school, because I went to a Christian school, and apparently dancing leads to babies, so you can't do that. And so we did not do dancing at our banquets. And so I decided that the Lord was not okay with this. And so we were going to hold our own dance. And because I lived in the Bay Area, we rented out a large party barge, essentially, and we held our own dance in the San Francisco Bay. And we're like, we are going to dance it up. It's going to be great. We took tickets, and it was really fun. And I still can't believe, like, my parents allowed me to do this as a junior in high school. I'm like a broker with tickets, like, how much you want, like, scalping stuff. And And I remember the moment that my girlfriend at the time was the one helping me plan this thing. And then all of a sudden, somehow, I'm not sure how, I became the messenger to another girl at the school of why her boyfriend couldn't come on the boat. Because my girlfriend didn't like him or something. And I still don't know why to this day. Doesn't even make sense. Doesn't matter. And so somehow I become the messenger of crazy. And so I very vividly remember going into our cafeteria, walking over to this other girl and be like, hey, your boyfriend can't come on the boat. Well, why not? And I can't think of a good reason. So I just, like, being a dude, I'm like, because my girlfriend says so. Like, that's all I had. Like, that was all I had, right? Completely throw her under the bus. But in the first place, I'm thrown under the bus because why am I doing this announcement? Why am I the public announcer of awkwardness, right? And so now there is drama. And now all of a sudden, this girl got a problem with my girlfriend, and that's, like, spreading to all these other people. I'm like, what is going on right now? Or, like, the idea of loving people. You know, it's a great ideal, and you like the idea of being here or even checking out this place, and it works really great until the person that you were dating shows up at the same place. And now, right, I have a few groans. And so now they're sitting, like, on the other side of the room. Hopefully this isn't the exact moment that's happening for you right now, and I apologize if I'm making it weirder. But not my fault, I'm just the messenger. And so this ideal of I want to be around a group of people and truly love them well is good in theory, but now real life comes colliding in and the ex-boyfriend or ex-girlfriend is here. And what do you do with that? And how do you navigate that? And maybe there's bad blood because it seems to be all breakups happen. As soon as somebody breaks up, they just start firing shots at each other of like, this is why I broke up. She crazy. And then she comes in and be like, you have no idea what this dude's really like. And it just gets weird. Drama. And that's a great ideal until it comes into collision with someone that you don't like because you've broken up. And you both come to church? Like, how do you deal with that? I remember a few years ago when I was in California, Northern California, and there's a group of friends, and one of them, they're all girls, and one of them was dating a guy, and he didn't believe what we believed, and it was great. It was great to see him there, and he was getting plugged into the community and feeling like a part of it, and all of a sudden, one day, the dude just wasn't there, and then he wasn't there the next week, and he wasn't there the next week. And so I go over to this girl and I say, hey, I see that your boyfriend's not here anymore. What's up? Like, I assume they broke up. And I go, hey, did you guys break up? And she's like, yeah, he broke up. And I was like, well, why isn't he here? And then just not even thinking about what she's saying, she says, well, I told him he wasn't allowed to come anymore because this is our church. The like rage that is inside me at this moment of like, you don't get to say that. I'm sorry. I didn't know that you're Jesus. Like you don't get to say that to people that you, sorry, no, we broke up. You're not allowed to come to my church. And it just was this very real moment of what it looks like to truly love another human being with their words. I was like, that was the moment that you should have captured that. And you did, like, you ran so far the other direction that now I've got to go do damage control as a pastor and be like, hey, just so you know, she doesn't totally represent all of us. Like, and all I wanted to do was go, no, you don't come. And then I call him up and be like, don't worry, she's not coming anymore. You can totally come. And like, that's what I wanted to do. But the reality is both should be there. And this idea of loving other people well with their words, all of a sudden what it comes colliding into is the drama that happens within relationship because relationship is how we live our life. In school, there were two words that could make me viscerally just sick more than anything else, and it was when the teacher used the words group project. Exactly, right? Some of y'all love it. I don't get it. Whatever. Most people don't. Because you know it's going to be weird because you know the group project dynamics. You've always got the one like super overachiever that's like completely nominates himself group leader and no one's like, no one wants them to be group leader. And then you got the one person or mainly everyone else that doesn't want to be there. And so they're making everyone else do the work. And then you got the people stuck in the middle. And drama is like this tornado of funk that just, it just sucks everything into into it. And it leaves you in this place going like, how did we get here? How did we get to this place that's weird? How do we get to this place where there's real animosity between human beings? And how do we get to this place where gossip and lies and cruelty and complaining, like all of this reigns? How do we get there? And what we want to do this morning is walk through not only simply how to survive this, but how do we actually rise above this and speak words of truth and grace and healing and life in the midst of this? And we're in our second week of our series called Speak No Evil. And the big idea for this entire series has been that our words matter because they reveal our heart and they hurt or they heal. Our words have weight. No matter what you believe about God, I think we can all recognize that our words have weight. We remember the hurtful things that people said to us, even if it was 10 years ago. We remember the life-giving things that people say to us, like, I'm proud of you, or a compliment. Even if it was small, we hang on to it because our words have weight. They really, really matter. Well, one of the reasons they matter is because they can hurt or heal. And these are the verses we looked at last week, just to give you an example. But in Ephesians, Paul writes, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. The biblical idea of grace is essentially something that you're given that you don't deserve. In fact, you deserve the opposite. How do we give words that even people don't deserve, but to build them up? And then in Proverbs, which is essentially an entire book of wisdom sayings, just one right after the other, it says that a gentle tongue is a tree of life. I mean, it gives life to a person, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. I think we know, all of us, what it's like to have your spirit broken by the words of another. And then again, in Proverbs a little bit earlier, it says there's one whose rash words, they're like sword thrusts, like just being stabbed right in the abdomen. But the tongue of the wise brings healing. And so there's these options that are given that you can either corrupt a person or give them grace. You can add life to them, or you can take that, or you can stab them and cause pain, or you can actually bring healing with the things you say. Our words matter, not just simply, this isn't a series about, hey, don't say naughty things. It is more importantly a series about what we ought to become with our words. And the second thing is that our words reveal our heart. They reveal the true nature of who we really are, the part of us that we don't want to confront. Though externally all looks well, and I'm generally a good person, and I don't do these crazy things, internally, in the recesses of my heart, sit the real me. The me that I don't want broadcast out there, the real me that has hatred, the real me that gossips, the real me that lies to cover over stuff, the real me that separates in relationship because of what I say. It reveals the real heart that's in us. Jesus says, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks, meaning that what you say betrays what's really going on internally. And as much as we think that we're doing a good job masking that, it always comes out. It's not a matter of if our words are going to come out and reveal what's going on internally. It's a matter of when. It's going to happen for all of us. And that every week we're asking the question, what does one of these things that happens, whether it be drama or gossip or lying, all this, what does it reveal about our heart? Why does it go on? Why, and the question you want to ask this morning is, why very specifically does needless drama happen in our lives? Being around someone that causes needless drama, it's like being in the car of a friend who can't drive. It's like some of y'all got that friend, and some of you maybe are that friend. And red lights are a suggestion for you. And yellow lights are like a dare. we have those friends, and if you don't, fair warning, one day maybe you will, or maybe you are that friend, you don't realize it. You're wondering, like, how, like, what is going on in your brain that computed to make that driving decision? And the same happens in drama in relationships. There's some sort of internal jacked up GPS that is happening, and you're left wondering, how did we get here? How did we get here? What is going on in the human heart that we end up in a place of needless drama in relationship? And the answer is, and always will be, the heart behind what drama reveals of our heart is pride. Every instance of needless drama in relationship, you can draw back to the GPS of the heart being pride. Somewhere along the way, someone started or made it worse because they made a prideful decision rather than a humble one. And what it reveals about our heart is that we all intrinsically, from the day we are born, enter this world as deeply arrogant and prideful people. We all do. And we all express it differently, but it is in our heart and it comes out. One of the things we've been saying, and we're going to be saying over the series, started this last week, is saying that if nothing else, what this series reveals is how much, despite externally maybe I behave very well, how much what's really going on in my heart reveals that I need someone more powerful than me, bigger than me, to do something in me I'm incapable of doing in myself. I need God to step in and transform me because I don't have the ability to transform my words. It reveals what's really going on. And one of the ways that we've seen this kind of played out is last week, and it's a small thing, handed out stickers to everybody that say speak no evil on them. And I've seen people where they place them. Most people put it on their phones some people put it in lockers and things like that. But if you want to join the pain with us, there's a bunch of leftover and extra stickers on the tables on your way out. Put those somewhere where it's going to be your best reminder of truly making the attempt to speak no evil. And one of the things that is going to happen, and I've already had great conversations with people, is that you're going to fail and you're going to fail miserably. And that's actually the point. To reveal how deeply we truly need Jesus to do in us what we are incapable of doing in ourselves. And what drama reveals is that our natural tendency, because we are sinful, busted, broken people living in a sinful, busted, broken world, our natural tendency is pride. See, a prideful heart stirs up and creates drama. A humble one kills drama. And so what we want to do this morning is look at three instances, three ways in which this happens. And so here we go. I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit. There we go. Turn to Genesis chapter 3, verse 18. I know I told you to go to Numbers. Hang on there and just kind of put a finger and go to Genesis chapter 3. And we're going to be very briefly in verses 8 through 13. This is the very beginning of the Bible. And here's what it says in Genesis 3, verses 8 through 13. So this is after Adam and Eve, the original people. Even if maybe the Bible's unfamiliar for you, maybe heard about Adam and Eve a little bit. And it says, and they, this is Adam and Eve, this is after they eat the fruit from the tree they were told not to. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of God among the trees in the garden. But then God called out to the man and said, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself." And last year we went through a whole series on this and unpacked it. But here's what I want to get to as the last part of this. He said, "Who told you that you're naked? Have you eaten of the tree which I commanded not to eat?" And then the man said, and it does not go well, "The woman whom you gave to be with me," keep in mind, she's standing right there, "she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate." And then she says, the Lord God says to the woman, "What have you done?" And says, "The woman said, 'The serpent deceived me and I eight. So immediately, we are three chapters into the Bible, and we got drama because one very specific thing, this is what pride does that creates drama, is that the prideful won't admit wrong, but the difference is the humble, they'll confess. The humble will be open and say, "Nope, I wronged. I did wrong. I wronged you," and they'll be open about that. Okay, so let's go back on this story a little bit, because poor Adam's about to get a beat down. so his opening line is, "The woman you gave me," and Eve is standing there like just right next. Like, I can't even imagine, like, if I ever did this, if my wife or if a guy ever did this, and his girlfriend or wife is standing right there, you know it is not going to go well for that dude. Adam is standing here and he's like, "It was her fault." And she's over here like, "Excuse me?" Like, "Excuse me?" And I won't, like even God in this moment is like backing up. Like, I mean, he's walking there. He's like, "You on your own, brother." Like, good luck with this. Because immediately, because Adam is unwilling to admit and own his own stuff, he's like, "It was her fault." Total, like, throws her under the bus, just doesn't even lead her at all, like, just weak, like, doesn't even help, just throws her. And this is what drama does, is drama happens or is made worse because, and you can always go to this, someone in the conflict is unwilling to admit their part of it. Someone in the conflict is unwilling to admit that they've sinned against the other person. We have a counseling ministry. And you would, maybe you would be surprised or not, is that very often one of the primary things that we do is we counsel married couples. And they come in, and they both got beef with each other. And probably for good reason, because again, we're sinful, then two sinful people marry, and they expect everything's going to be all perfect. Turns out it's actually kind of not. It's difficult. And so they come in. And we look at the wife and we go, "What's going on?" And she goes and she complains about her husband, says, "This is what he's doing. He's the worst. Like, he does this, this, and this." And we go, "Okay, thank you." Then we go to the husband and go, "All right, you tell us the story." And so he goes, "Well, this is what she does. And she does this, and she does this, and she does this. Like, she's the worst. Can't believe we're married." And then the counselor is going to go to each of them and go, "Okay, ma'am, I'm not interested in talking about your husband. In fact, I'm glad you brought him along. But we're not, in my conversations with you, I'm not going to talk about him. You're not going to talk about him? I came to talk about him. No, we're not going to talk about him. Let's talk about you." And then all of a sudden, you can see the countenance change. And she used to be mad at him. Now she's mad at the counselor. "What do you mean you're going to talk about me? I'm not doing anything wrong. He's the problem." "Oh, I will be willing to put money on that's not true." And then he goes, "Yeah, that's right. We're going to talk about her." "Oh, hold up there, chief. We're going to talk about you too. Because guess who is the other part of the problem? It's you." "No, no, man, she's the problem. You just said it. You're both the problem." And you, every time, the moment that we turn the conversation around to, "Let's talk about your part in this conflict," people shut down or they get angry. Because we are convinced, drama is convinced that it's the other person that is the problem and is unwilling to admit their role in this. In the book of James, this is Jesus' brother. He says, "Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be" what? "Healed." Confession, meaning I openly share my mistake in the conflict brings healing. There is no promise that the other person in the conflict will do the same, but you have done your part. See, confession will bring healing, at minimum to you, maybe to the conflict in the relationship. But what will never bring healing is an unwillingness to admit your part in it, even if your part is tiny. And there's going to be people in this room, you've got drama right now. And it's not even like a little bit of fake drama that's just going to pass by quickly. It's very real relational strife. Whatever you do next, wherever this relationship goes, the most important thing that you can do is go back to that person and start by admitting you're wrong. You confess your part and you say nothing else. You don't blame them. You don't accuse them. You don't say anything. You'll get to that point one day. But the first thing we do in any conflict, so it doesn't blow up into drama, is you admit your fault and you better do it as quickly as you can. Because the longer that lingers, the harder it gets to do, and the more bitterness sets in. See, drama happens because people are unwilling to admit they're wrong. But the humble, they confess it, and so it kills the drama. Okay, now let's go to Numbers 13. Numbers chapter 13, verse 25. And this is a little bit of a long section, so I'm going to read it. And at a certain point, I'm going to annoy you a lot. I am going to read it with the appropriate voice inflection. Fair warning, my voice is going to get real high-pitched and whiny. Sorry. A lot of groaning this morning. Great. Okay, so here's the story. Let me give you context. So Israel, we know this from history, both biblical history and outside, that Israel were slaves in Egypt for 500 years. And during that time and after that, God had promised, I'm going to give you a home. You have no home. Your entire nation has been enslaved. I'm going to give you a home, and I promise you where it's going to be. And so it became known as, in Scripture, the Promised Land. And so then Israel leaves Egypt, and they find themselves wandering in the desert for a generation. And they, this entire time, have been anticipating, looking forward to this Promised Land. And so they arrive at the edge of what we now know as like Israel and Palestine and all of that. They arrive at the edge of it, and they are full of expectation. They have heard what it is like. It's called a land that is flowing with milk and honey, which meant it's just fertile, and there you could grow crops and build homes and raise families, and it's safe. I mean, they've been slaves and beaten and murdered, and so in a good sense, they have all of this weight of entire nations of expectation of what this land is going to be. And so to prepare to enter it, they get 12 guys. One from what was each tribe of Israel. So the nation was broken down into 12 groups. And they send one from each. And they come back, and this is the report they give, and this is the response of the people. At the end of the 40 days, so they were in the land for a month and 10 days, they came to Moses and Aaron, who were leading at the time, and it says, to all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran and Kadesh, he said, they brought back the word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. They told them, we came to this land which you sent us. It truly does flow with milk and honey and its fruit. Then verse 28, drama. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites. And they start, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea. So they talk about all these people. But then Caleb quieted them. And he says, let us go up and occupy it. We will be able to overcome it. Then the men who had gone with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than we are. So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that, and here's where it gets really dramatic, it devours its inhabitants. No place devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw there of a great height. And then we saw the Nephilim. If you're familiar with their Bible, there's a whole weird thing that happens, and we're just going to pass over it to not live in the creepiness. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers. And so we seemed to them. They didn't see you, but whatever. And then this little drama that these guys start, because all they're doing is complaining, it goes to a whole nother level. And then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. And the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, and this is where it gets super whiny, would that we have died in the land of Egypt, or that we would have died in the wilderness. That would have been better. Why is our Lord bringing us to this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become prey. Why would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? Pause. Think about what they're saying. It's so bad, something we've never seen before. We've never been in there. It's going to be so bad that you know what's going to be better than that? 500 years of slavery. Let's go back to that. They are just brilliant. And then they said to one another, let's choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Let that sink in for a second. Let's choose a leader. Moses is standing right there, by the way. And let's go back to Egypt. Drama is a tornado that just swallows up everybody in its path. And here's Moses, and here's the two spies, and their names are Caleb and Joshua, are standing there going, what? What in the world just happened? And I think there's times in our life where we're like a part of this, and we're just standing there going, what in the world just happened? How did we go from here to back to Egypt so we can be slaves and build the pyramids? That is beyond the definition of insane. And what is happening and what it reveals in the human heart is that the prideful complain, but the humble trust God. The prideful look at the situation, and because their expectations are not met, they start complaining. So one of the things that's always going to be hard for us to deal with in life is the gap between what I expect and over here, reality. And somewhere in that open space in between, your life is going to be filled with something. And you are going to either fill it with unrest and complaining and bitterness and disappointment, or you're going to fill that space by pointing to a God who truly interjects into our life and has our good in mind and truly is for his people's good, even in difficult circumstances. Either that space is going to be filled with trust in a real God that really interjects into life, or I'm going to fill that space with complaining and bitterness. And you look at all the things they do. They lie, they exaggerate, they complain, they disrespect Moses and Caleb and Joshua. And the end result of this is they end up wandering for an entire generation. And God says, fine, you don't want the land? An entire generation of them die in the desert. And he says, I'm going to give it to your kids, who hopefully will do better than you guys did. And that was the end result of it. We are going to fill that space with something. See, we're going to fill the gap between making the team, our expectation to make the team, and reality with something. In pride, I can fill that space by saying things like, the coach is stupid, and that's why he didn't pick me. He doesn't get it. Or in humility, I say, okay, God desires to grow me through this. The gap between the grades I want and then what I actually get. In pride, I say things like, the teacher doesn't like me. That's why I got the grade I did. In humility, I maybe say, what God is trying to show me is that my integrity is tied to my effort. An F in this class, knowing that I am a believer, is tied to my integrity that I have and my character and my witness. See, the gap between the family I want and the reality of the family I have, in that space, you can badmouth them behind their back. Even if the stories are true, it's still behind their back. Or in humility, I trust that I have the parents and the boundaries I do for a reason. And even if my family is very dysfunctional, I have the opportunity for a family within a family in this place. The gap between the ideal girlfriend or boyfriend that I've built in my head, and then the reality when I enter into the relationship. See, when it doesn't go so well, I can make wild claims like, there are no good guys out there. They're all terrible. That's pride speaking, because it's not true. Or after the relationship ends, I slander them. I go after them because it hurts that it's over. Or in humility, I trust that God really does have a plan for my relationships. The gap between what I want church to be and what it actually ends up being, because there's people here and people are messed up and it's funky. See, in pride, I mock the people. I mock the service. I mock the speaking. I mock the worship. I mock what people are wearing. I mock how they interact at church because it's not what I expected. But in humility, I trust that God actually has something to say to me through imperfect people. See, the space between expectation and reality, you're going to fill with one of two things. What we're called to fill that with, especially when people come to us with their unmet expectations, is we are meant to fill that by pointing people back to a God they can trust rather than circumstances they can complain. And then drama happens because we complain rather than seeing the larger picture. The last thing the drama does, or that the heart does, is that the prideful, they're in it for themselves. But the humble, they actually benefit others. One of my favorite sports that I have never seen it live, never, is hockey. Hockey is awesome. Okay, I want to go to a hockey game. I want to go to an NHL game or semi-pro or whatever. And there's only one thing I want to see happen. What do you think it is? Yes. We're on the same page. That's all I want to see. You know what makes hockey amazing? Is you can fight in it and they take the gloves off. Boxing, they put gloves on. Hockey, they're like, take your helmet off, take the gloves off. By the way, there's ice and and you literally have knives on your feet and you got a giant club for a stick and go. And it's like, yes, this is amazing. This is a real sport. This is so great. And then all I want to do is I want to see a hockey fight. So something interesting happened in 1977 in the NHL. Well, they don't have a problem with fighting in hockey. So they instituted this rule, and it's now become known as the third man rule. They, in hockey, will allow two dudes to just wail on each other till there's blood on the ice. They're fine with it. And the refs will let it go unless it's going to like deeply harm somebody, which I think every punch would. But to a point, they let it go. Well, here's the thing. In 1977, they instituted a rule where whoever the third person into the fight was the one that got the penalty. As soon as the third person left the line or left the bench and started and jumped into the fight, like all of a sudden just came like flying in like a haymaker and dropping somebody, that was the person that got suspended. That was the person that got penalized. Because here's what the NHL found, and this is true in hockey and it is true in life. As soon as you add a third person into the fight, what was a conflict now becomes a straight up brawl. Because as soon as that third person in and like threw that haymaker, well, guess what the other team's doing? Go like, whoa, 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 whoa. You do not get to do that. And all of a sudden now the goalies are fighting in the corner. It's weird because they got padding and they just fall over on each other. It looks like a weird ice sumo thing. And like, so a fight, a conflict, which conflict is not bad. A conflict between two people is not always drama. Don't confuse that. A conflict is not always drama. But drama happens when someone who doesn't belong in the fight gets into the fight. And all of a sudden, it balloons and it blows up. And we disguise our entrance into a fight that we don't belong in, even if, say, it's our best friend and they're in a fight with somebody and we want to support our best friend. The best thing you can do for that friend is point them to resolving that conflict. You stay out of it. Stay out of it. And we'll read through the one verse that says you can get in, but 99.99% of the time, we are called to stay out of it. And what is so twisted in our heart is that we can't stay out of it because in pride, we want to be in the middle. We like being in the mix. We like, and this is where it gets real jacked up, we like that they need to come to us for help because that means that I now have something to offer in that. I've got wisdom and advice and help to offer. And we disguise our pride as things like loyalty. We say, I'm just being loyal. No, you can't stay out of it. Or I just give wisdom. No, no, no. You're prideful and you can't stay out of it. Or, you know what? I just got my friends back. No, you're prideful and you feed off of conflict in your friend's life. And you can't stay out of it. In Romans chapter 12, verse 15, Paul says, rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. You know what pride does? This is so twisted. It takes that and it reverses it. And what ends up happening is even with people we love, we rejoice in their mourning because that means now they need us. That is selfishness and pride personified. Come to me because I'll fix you. And all it does is point people away from the Jesus that truly fixes them, that truly brings hope and healing in our life. There's one verse that says that you can hop in. It's in Matthew 18. It says, look, if your brother sins against you, go tell him his fault between you and him alone. Interesting that that's the starting place. But if he listens to you, you've gained a brother. You're fine. It ends there. But if he doesn't, take one or two others along with you that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. The only instance in all of Scripture that says, yeah, you can go ahead and bring somebody, but what makes this different is that it is 100% for the benefit of the other person. This is conflict, not unnecessary drama. And it's for their benefit, not ours, and it's for God's glory and not ours. See, pride always seeks out our glory and our selfishness, our gain over another person's. The prideful are selfish and they disguise their help. They disguise their pride as help. But those that are humble go, all right, I'm gonna stay out of it. This is between the two of you. Y'all work it out. I'm not gonna step into this. I wanna close with this verse. And it's in Philippians chapter 2, and this is verses 3-5, and it says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Do not, let me read it differently. Do not create drama out of your selfishness and self-focus. Do not create drama by being unwilling to admit your fault. Do not create drama by complaining and pulling other people in. Do not create drama by stepping into a fight that is not yours, but rather in humility, value other people above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, your pride, but each of you to the interests of others. And in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus. Look, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you to just magically walk out of here and stop furthering drama, because it's not going to work that way. We know we can't stop. But instead, what I want to say is the only way to stop is to change our heart. What I'd like to do is invite the worship team to come on up. And as they're doing that, we are going to spend some time singing to the very person that radically changes our heart. See, when Jesus came and died and rose again, he started the process in us that he is the very reason that we can have humility. Because think of it in this terms. He gave us what we do not deserve. In humility, he was sacrificed on our behalf to make us new and transform people. That his death and resurrection counts for us. And I can be humble to admit my faults to other people, because becoming a follower of Christ starts with one thing. I have to start by admitting that I need a Jesus, that I need Jesus to do what I can't do in myself. That's humility. So I've already started in humility, so I can now like take that humility and live that out with other people. Not only does it do that, but in humility, think of what that is. I am trusting that this death and resurrection counts for me. That is a huge leap of trust. It is a smaller leap to trust that God is in our circumstances and I don't have to complain. So Jesus' death and resurrection also gives me the ability, I'm humbled enough to trust God. And then finally, I can stay out of conflicts because I now know firsthand what Jesus does in the human heart. And I can let go of trying to be other people's Jesus. And I can let go of my pride trying to jump in and fix them. Instead, I now in humility can point them back to the one that does. And really the starting place for us to do that this morning is using this time. And I want to leave you with the question, where in your life are you recognizing that your pride is causing or furthering drama?